on ABC Local Radio, Radio Australia and the World Wide Web. This is Sunday Nights with John Cleary.
Hello there and welcome to Sunday Night on Radio Australia and the World Wide Web. Those on ABC Local Radio are not with us for the moment. They'll be joining us in about an hour's time. And because of that, we're going to change the order of things this evening. First up, we're going to be discussing one of the sidebar stories of the week with Bishop Richard Williamson on Holocaust denial and concerns over the Vatican's link to the Nazi Party in the past. Then we'll have a look at one of the world's continuing sore spots, groan and travail in the Gaza over the last few weeks as the Israeli forces have made an impact in that area which reverberates on world affairs. Then we're bringing it all back home. In our second hour this evening, we'll concentrate on the meaning of tragedy as we reflect on the Victorian bushfires, the outcome for both those who now face rebuilding their own lives, those who work with them, and the wider questions of meaning and ultimate purpose. These questions open for all of us. A busy Sunday night on ABC Radio around Australia. And of course, the interesting bits and pieces, the quiz, a meditation and the chat room. All of this on Sunday night. To begin, we'll look back now at a discussion last year that Stephen Crittenden of the ABC's Radio Religious Unit had with Kevin Spicer, the author of a book released last year on Hitler's priests. It puts us in the context of the discussion that has raged over the last couple of weeks over Bishop Richard Williamson and his readmission into the church by Pope Benedict. Why is that discussion so tense? Well, here's Stephen Crittenden to help explain why.
Vor uns liegt Deutschland, in uns marschiert Deutschland und hinter uns kommt Deutschland.
More than 60 years after the death of Adolf Hitler, the books and films keep coming, but we're still really only at the edges of understanding what happened under the Third Reich and how people fell into such depravity. We're looking at the small minority of Catholic priests in Germany who were active supporters of the Nazi Party. Known as Brown Priests, they were a constant headache for their bishops. They were mostly anti-Semites, some were Gestapo informants, a few even left the priesthood to join the SS. Hitler's Priests is a new book by American Catholic priest and historian Kevin Spicer. He's Associate Professor of History at Stony Hill College and visiting professor at Notre Dame University in the United States. Hitler's Priests closely follows the careers of about a dozen of these so-called brown priests, and its extraordinary appendix contains short biographies of 138 of them. Let me read you just one. Georg Elling, OSB, born 1899, infantryman in World War I, ordained as a Benedictine in 1927. He leaves the order the following year and leaves the Catholic Church in 1930. He's a preacher in the Free Religious Protestant Church and then the German Faith Movement until 1935. Joins the Nazi Party May 1st, 1933. Joins the SS November 1935 and works as a race consultant in the intelligence service known as the SD. Imagine having race consultant on your business card. He marries in November 1937. He works for the SD in the East. And from November 1943, he's in Rome, stationed at the German embassy to the Holy See. He's arrested by the Americans in 1944, classified as a criminal Category 1, which is reduced to Category 3 at his denazification appeal in 1949. Well, we're joined now by Kevin Spicer. Kevin, there are 138 brown priests in the list at the back of your book, 53 are card-carrying members of the Nazi Party, 42 hold one or more doctorates, 28 left the priesthood. I count about 20 who joined the SA or the SS or who acted as Gestapo informants. This is a very strange group. Tell us about them.
These were men for a variety of different ages, from very young, just newly ordained, to people who were older. Many of them had served in World War I or had some type of chaplaincy experience. Most of them were outward anti-Semites prior to the National Socialists coming to power, whether holding traditional religious anti-Semitism or embracing some aspect of racial anti-Semitism, clearly looking very negatively on Jews. Most of them were very against the Weimar Republic, did not like democracy, did not like the change that happened after World War I in Germany. So we have a variety of factors that are motivating these individuals. And their motivation led them usually to right-wing groups, often first thinking about a restoration of the monarchy. When that idea seemed not to be able to work in some fashion, they moved more towards the right, often getting involved with the German National People's Party, and then finally usually getting involved with the National Socialist Party.
They seem to be, as a group, fairly marginal, isolated figures, difficult to manage, irascible, desperate for recognition in some cases. But on the other hand, there are contradictions. In several cases, you note that when a bishop moves against one of these priests, they're strongly supported by the people in their local parish or town. Mm-hmm. And in one case in Austria in 1938, about the time of the Anschluss, you give some very interesting figures. 525 priests join a Nazi priests association. 1,800 indicate their sympathy. They don't seem to be completely isolated. There do seem to be contradictions in that picture there.
That's right. I think for the 138 of the individuals that I identify, we do have a lot of people who saw themselves as special, or those who wanted to have more recognition, or those who stood out from the rest and often didn't fit in very well with their fellow clerics. They didn't attend clergy meetings. They were not very active in their local deaneries with other priests, or they had tensions or difficulty even prior with their bishop. That's not true of all, but that's true of many. Some of them looked towards the party as a means to help them to get out of trouble with the bishop and perhaps to support them and even to rise in power.
Another of the things that stands out about this group as a group, many of them had been chaplains or medics or even infantrymen on the Western or Eastern fronts during the First World War. And I suspect, reading between the lines of your book, that they're suffering from shock and humiliation and confusion about Germany's defeat, and that in that sense they may be typical of, well, the same German soldier class that Hitler himself came from.
Very much so. You take a figure like Josef Roth. He had served in the trenches. In fact, I talked to his great niece. She remembers in the family album a picture of Hitler and Roth together in World War I. It's not existent anymore. She said her grandmother tore it up at some point. But clearly they shared this trench camaraderie. I have a picture in the book. You can see Roth at his day of ordination. He has his priest cassock on. He's very proud with his family, but pinned to his cassock are the medals that he earned during the war. That's how important it was to him. And his writing and everything he talked about had very nationalistic overtures, very anti-Semitic overtures, condemned the Weimar Republic, condemned Germany for the path it was taking of democracy, saying that religion had become feminized and weak and that it had to become strong and manly again, talking about a manly image of Christ, not a weak image of Christ, that Christ had come into the world really to combat Jews, to combat all the evil that was in the world, and wrote, preached to his fellow infantrymen who had joined the Freikorps, joined the right-wing movements, and joined the National Socialist Party. He preached on German Day. They commemorated some of the battles going back to German unification. To about 100,000 men, he was up before all of them, giving a benediction and then preaching this fire and brimstone homily that was full of anti-Semitism and nationalism. Hitler was in attendance. Ludendorff, one of the World War I generals who was involved in the right-wing movement after the war, was in attendance.
How many of these priests have full-blown racial anti-Semitism as their primary motivation, and how many are motivated more by a desire to make being a Catholic compatible with being a loyal member of the Nazi state?
When you look at the evidence, there are only a handful that are really spouting racial anti-Semitism. You have many, we don't know what they thought. They didn't write anything. We know they worked for the party. We know they were a card-carrying member. But they didn't write anything, so we don't have exact evidence, and I have to work from evidence as a historian. But we do have a few. One of the ones that stands out the clearest, just to give a case example, is Richard Kleine from Duderstadt, who was involved with some priests from Austria and helped set up this National Socialist Priest Group. There were a lot of people who were interested in it, as you alluded to before, but the actual set members who worked on projects was quite small.
Kleine writes, in fact, about a theological final solution.
He does. He's writing about this in the 40s. Right around the time of the Holocaust. He does not have knowledge of the gas chambers, but he is using similar language that mirrors what the National Socialists are using in their writing. But he does talk about persecution of Jews. He's very clear that Jews are sent to ghettos in this period of time. And he's talking about segregation. He's talking about limiting freedom of Jews. And then he's using this idea of eradicating any type of Jewish influence from the scriptures and using that terminology of this final solution.
Mm. One of the priests you've studied, Philip Heusser, writes an essay in 1943 condemning genocide, but it was never actually published, and you raise the possibility that it was intended as a self-serving effort. He speaks about the slaughter of thousands of Jewish women and children. He calls it an evil deed that screams to heaven. He says it will destroy Germany's honour and bring about international compassion for the Jews.
Yes, this essay is just, I was really astonished when I found it because it doesn't go along with anything else that he said. Other than that, he was always cautious about recognizing that if a Jewish person wanted to convert to Catholicism, that that would be the ultimate goal. And he did say that several times in his essays, despite all the hatred and many hate-filled things that he said, he did acknowledge that several times in his earlier works.
We're looking at the Brown Priests, the Nazi priests in Germany, in a new book called Hitler's Priests by Kevin Spicer. One of the most prominent of the Brown Priests was an elderly Benedictine abbot named Albanus Schachleiter. And he's on the front cover of your book in his Benedictine habit making a Nazi salute surrounded by SA men in uniform. And there are other photographs of him saying mass surrounded by swastika flags. He was personally close to Hitler early on. But it's interesting that soon after Hitler comes to power, it's pretty clear that he's pushing him away.
Yes. Yes. Schachleiter is very upset with the repression that takes place against the Catholic Church by the state.
Nazi totalitarianism has no place for accommodating the Church.
That's true, and I think it was a development. I don't think it was something right at the beginning. Very early in the movement, there was some goal to work with the churches. A colleague of mine, Derek Hastings, believes that the Nazi Party actually was Catholic at the very beginning, and by the time of the putsch had more or less turned away from that because there were more Protestants moving and or people who were totally secular, and many Catholics had left the movement. He has a study that should come out soon about that.
Let's just talk also about Bernard Stemfel, OSH, who's an interesting character because he's murdered during the so-called Night of the Long Knives on July the 2nd, 1934. And it's thought that happened because he knew the truth that Adolf Hitler had either deliberately or accidentally shot dead his own niece, Geli Raubal, in his Munich apartment a couple of years earlier.
Right. It wasn't that Hitler had killed her himself, but that he had her killed, or that Stemfle knew more about the affair that went on between Hitler and his niece. Stemfle's case is very mysterious because everybody has mentioned him. His name appears. He appears in Ian Kirschall's biography of Hitler. He appears in Conrad Haydn's study of Hitler. But no one had really systematically tried to find out about him. And so that really interests me, and I always like to dig through the archives. And I was able, through writing a letter to the Vatican, The congregation that deals with religious orders did send me some information from their files on him to find out that definitely, yes, he was a priest, because that was always a question. Was he? Some people said he was a Jesuit, he wasn't a Jesuit. What order did he belong to? He belonged to a very small religious community that actually was disbanded, and he was kind of on his own. And he really more or less stops operating as a priest. But he's very influential with Hitler and becomes part of Hitler's inner circle. So he knew a lot about Hitler. He was involved, supposedly, you know, I don't have a document there. I'm using the testimony of some of the people who wrote about Hitler at the time, that he was involved in helping edit Mein Kampf. He was a journalist, regularly wrote for newspapers, and then just appeared with Hitler quite a bit and would be at his table, the Stammtisch, the regular tables that he would have in Munich, be there as a guide, almost as a confessor there to him. By this point, he was not acting as a priest. Most people called him Professor Stempfle, though he didn't have a doctorate or anything. But he clearly knew something, or he had some information, because on the night of the Long Knives, and actually this information came from the Library of Congress, a colleague of mine alerted me to that. There were some pictures of which one appears in the book between Stempfle and Hitler. And then there was this account of his death. And during that night, he was taken from the family's home and he was executed.
Now, let's just talk about the German bishops. These priests are obviously very difficult for their bishops to manage. I mean, someone like Abbot Albanus Schachleiter is personally close to Hitler. So was Joseph Roth. I notice another one of the priests in your appendix, August Partin, was a cousin of Heinrich Himmler. It's fair to say, I think, that the bishops didn't handle them well, but on the whole, they weren't encouraging or supportive, were they? And they did often act against them, and many of these priests were dismissed from the priesthood.
That's right. An individual such as Cardinal Michael von Faulhaber of Munich and Freising, that diocese is as Catholic as you can get. He had been in his office for a long period of time. He had a lot of experience as a churchman. He had a lot of interaction between church and state. Wrote from 23 on, soon after Roth's ordination, wrote a pamphlet about Catholicism and Judaism that was very negative towards Jews, even had racial anti-Semitism in the pamphlet. Faulhaber calls him in, says, "You did not get permission. You have to, you know, I'm your superior. You have to get permission to publish this. Why did you do this? All this does is create problems." Never critiqued specifically the racial anti-Semitism in the pamphlet, but really gave Roth a scolding and told him he would never accept this again.
Someone like Faulhaber is certainly not pro-Nazi, but obviously some of the German bishops were. You mentioned Bishop Franz Xaver Eberle of Augsburg.
Eberle was very clearly pro. He was a nationalist, and I think he did a lot of things that would be very positive towards the state. I mean, he did get upset when the state persecuted the church in some fashion, but he did help Heuser. Anytime Heuser, this is Philip Heuser, was a friend of his, one of the Brown priests, anytime he had a trouble with the main bishop, Kampfmüller, Eberle, who was the auxiliary bishop in the Diocese of Augsburg, would intercede and allowed Heuser to stay in his parish. But clearly he has some Brown taint on his robes, his ecclesiastical robe.
Yeah. The historian Gunther Levy writes about how the German bishops actually condemned resistance and discouraged it, and that right to the end of the war, they never tired of admonishing the faithful to accept Hitler's government as the legitimate lawmaking authority.
Right. I think Gunter Lewis' book has a lot to say, and it stood up over time. I think there's a lot of very good points in that book, and I've let him know that myself. I do think that is perhaps a little harsh on all the bishops. They did support the war, and as the war went on and it got harder, they kind of stepped back in many ways, and they started to, you have a lot of cases of just dedicating diocese to the Sacred Heart and dealing much more in a spiritual realm than really dealing with some of the tough issues that were outside.
I guess we've got to also remember that 326 German priests were in Dachau when it was liberated by the Americans, and hundreds, perhaps thousands, had been through Dachau. Many had died there. You've written about Catholic resistance to the Nazis in another book. One of my favourites of all the hundreds upon hundreds of saints beatified by John Paul II is Bernard Lichtenberg, who was the Dean of St. Hedwig's Cathedral in Berlin, who prayed for the Jews publicly every Sunday after Mass and died on his way to Dachau, one of the few who perhaps saw clearly what the church was confronted with?
I think so. He's exceptional, Lichtenberg. I a chapter in my first book is dedicated to him and his life and telling that story. And naturally, the church has acknowledged that because he's blessed on his way to sainthood. And I'm very clear that he will gain that one day. His life was a life of combat and fighting. You know, he grew up at a time right after the Kulturkampf. His family had suffered from that. He lived in an area with a heavily Protestant population. They had been persecuted themselves. They had seen a lot of families persecuted. They'd seen pastors and people go to jail. So he kind of grew up with this fighting spirit, and he didn't take anything sitting down. He was a very traditional churchman, didn't buy into the new theology, and he knew when something wasn't right, and he wasn't afraid to combat that. You can't just judge his last record when he stood up and, you know, regularly, as you say, for several years he got up specifically after the evening prayer service, and I mean during that, and he prayed for Jews, not only for Catholics of Jewish heritage, but for Jews generally, which no one else was doing. The story which I recount is, and I don't want to be mean to Protestants anyway, but two young women who were of the Protestant tradition came into the church on an assignment from their teacher to see the architecture in St. Hedwig's, the cathedral where he was preaching. And they came in and they heard him say, pray for the Jews. And they went back and they told one of their classmates, and this young woman's father was an SS man. And she told her father, and then he lodged a formal complaint, and they went after Lichtenberg. They did a search of his house. Now, they already had a file on him, because he had already, back in 1935, had somebody wrote a report about the concentration camp in Germany, Esterwegen. He took that report from the person who wrote it, put his own name on it, and went to Goering's office and said, you know, I demand to see Goering. I demand to know what's going on. Well, naturally, Goering wouldn't meet with him, and another official did, but that document was lodged with the powers that be in the Reich, and it went up through the channels. They knew his name. The superintendent of all the concentration camps knew who he was and said, well, let's bring Lichtenberg in and let him spend a little time here, and he'll get to know how efficient our camps are. And that report specifically criticized the treatment of Jews in the camps, who had to do more of the dirty work, such as cleaning latrines and things, than other prisoners. And Lichtenberg put his name on that, and he just has one step after the next. So that his last thing just wasn't the only thing he did. And he was getting ready to make a major public pronouncement when he was arrested. He had it written up and planning to do that the following week. They searched his house. They found a copy of Mein Kampf, which he had annotated. And he's one of the few priests I've ever seen in the trial documents where he actually said, yes, I said that. Yes, I don't agree with the state. I said that. And he boldly answered their question. Mm.
He, of course, famously also volunteered when he was convicted to be sent to the Lodz ghetto in Poland to be with the Jews.
No, he's unique, and, you know, I hold him up in my first work, you know, as an exception. He's the resistor, and I'm working on a new book now. My original idea was to write about all the priests in Germany who spoke out in some way for Jews. Not mainly actually went and tried to save somebody, but just spoke out publicly and did something. And in my research, I find I don't have enough material for a book. Most clergy were concentrating on their own parishioners, their own world, and when you ask that question, who is neighbor, they're starting to put circles around clarifying, in a sense, that, you know, my family, my neighbors next door, the people in my parish.
And is this a sign that everyone in Germany is terrified to immobility? You know, we can't imagine what it would be like to be terrified on a daily basis by our government.
Well, I've interviewed priests, and they just said, you know, I said, why didn't you do more? Why didn't you say more? And they said, I was not ready to be a martyr. I do not have the courage to do that, and I honor those who were able to do that. And I've heard that from more than one person.
We haven't mentioned the much maligned Pius XII, and there's an interesting moment in your book where two of these brown priests, Richard Kleiner and Johann Pirscher, are writing to each other about the death of Pius XI in 1939 and rejoicing that this means the end of the influence of his Secretary of State, Cardinal Eugenio Pacelli, who'd been the nuncio in Berlin. They describe him as the most dangerous opponent of the new Germany. And then a month later, they're appalled when Pacelli is elected Pius XII.
Yes. It's an amazing story, I find, because, you know, Pius XII, from so many people, is just seen, you know, he's become a symbol of what the church did not do during the Holocaust. I don't even think we can get past that today, where no matter what evidence we have, for many people, he's just the symbol of the church's forgetting and ambivalence or unwillingness to react to the
Holocaust. But at least two of these brown priests clearly saw him as a powerful opponent of Nazism.
of Nazism that did not mean at the same time that they saw him as a person who spoke out for Jews, but they would have seen him, for example, as Secretary of State behind the lack of the Vatican's willingness to reach out to National Socialism, because they kept saying, you know, if you reach out, all of this restriction and problems, this would be ended. If you just work with the Nazis, just open your eyes and do that. And Pirscher and Kleine, they just couldn't understand why the church wouldn't. And they were attributing all of this to Pacelli. And I don't think anybody else has that same insight on Pacelli, because he seems always the other way quite often, except for the people who really work to defend him.
Stephen Crittenden with Kevin Spicer, the author of Hitler's Priests. You're on Sunday Night on ABC Radio. An insight there into the controversy that has dogged the Vatican over the past couple of weeks.